I'd like to welcome you to the Austrian Circle. This is the program where we talk about the economics of freedom here on WHUS Stores 91.7 FM. So thank you so much for tuning into my show this morning. We are going to be defending capitalism on the show today. Capitalism is what gives us immense prosperity. It brings us up from the wasteland of nature where nothing has been refined for us into usable consumer goods, and it changes nature into things that benefit us immensely. Air conditioning, cars, wonderful buildings that we can put all of our stuff in. Capitalism has made all of this possible, and none of it would be possible without the methodology of profit and loss and production. And one of the places I want to focus on is where capitalism gives us more time for leisure, more time for our friends, for our family, and allows us to do things in a more efficient way so that we can get things out of the way. We can offload some of our tasks to maybe other people who are going to handle it for us, or we can accumulate enough wealth that we can hire people, or we can buy machines that help us immensely in those tasks. And so one of the ways that capitalism has helped us is by bringing our families together and allowing us to have more time to spend with them. So the first article I would like to read talks about Mother's Day and how capitalism has helped mothers to have more time to spend with their children. And this article is by Stephen Horowitz. It was posted on the Foundation for Economic Education. Capitalism created modern motherhood. This piece is dedicated to my mom as I celebrate my first Mother's Day without her. With Mother's Day upon us, it's worth taking a moment to consider the vision of motherhood that we normally celebrate on this day. The holiday's origins, interestingly enough, come from celebrations of the role of mothers in the public arena, in particular as anti-war activists. But in the 20th century, the holiday changed to celebrate first individual mothers and now motherhood as an institution. Even as the last 100 years have brought enormous changes to gender roles in parenting, we still use the day to honor the domestic contributions of mothers in the form of their love and care for their children. The ability of mothers to engage in such activity, particularly to do so as a full-time endeavor, is, however, a relatively recent phenomenon. In fact, it's fair to say that it became a possibility thanks to the advent of capitalism and the wealth it created. For most of human history, the family was the unit of economic production, with the father overseeing production, not unlike a modern CEO. Wives, mothers, children, and extended family all worked the land or in the cottage industry, and most people teetered on the edge of economic survival. Since many mothers were expected either to be carrying children or contributing to earning income themselves, the care of children was often primarily overseen by grandparents or somewhat older children. In some cases, childcare was farmed out to women who served as wet nurses. For the majority of the population, the idea of a woman being a full-time mother was simply not feasible at this time. Capitalism accomplished two things that changed the nature of motherhood forever. First, by ushering in the onset of the Industrial Revolution, it took production out of the home and into the factory, or the market more broadly. The household began to shift from a site of production to one of consumption. At first, both women and children participated in this market work, as they had done in the pre-industrial era. But then the second effect took over. Wealth began to increase, capital became more productive, and therefore labor got more productive. That enabled women and children to exit the market workforce, as men were able to earn enough income to support the whole family. And it is here that modern motherhood finds its roots. freed from the marketplace, women were able to devote a significant amount of time towards household production, especially the care of children. This was not much easier than working in the factories or the farm in the days before electrical appliances, but it helped mothers to make it possible for their children to get better care and to survive to adulthood. Improved medical technology and scientific knowledge, along with greater material time and resources that were beginning to be devoted to children, meant a reduction in infant mortality rates. As a result, children began to acquire a degree of sentimental value that they rarely had before. After all, since they were more likely to live past infancy, parents began to invest themselves emotionally to a degree that they hadn't dared to before. This is not to say that the pre-industrial parents did not treat their kids with any sentimentality, only that, on the margin, changing economic conditions made it less risky and potentially less painful. This new vision of childhood ushered in a time where young people were kept out of the world of work and instead educated in schools and cared for in the home. It helped to ensure that children were integrated into the world of domesticity and the private female sphere. And perhaps unsurprisingly, it was most easily achieved by the urban middle class, which had the greatest ability to survive on a single income. The emergence of the sheltered childhood had a number of benefits. It became a rationale for investing in children's education and trying to better understand the conditions under which children might flourish. It also made childhood a far more enjoyable stage in human development than it had ever been. Spared not just from the world of work, but increasingly from mistreatment, disease, and competition over limited household resources, children were able to explore, learn, and grow. It's worth noting that the same economic growth that had made this sort of childhood possible also shifted the nature of marriage. As the need for economic collaboration faded, more couples began to marry for love. Another obvious form of this increased sentimentality was the reconceiving of motherhood in the domestic form we associate today with Mother's Day. Childhood was being reconceived as a time of innocence, play, and education, all taking place out of sight of the adult world of work and politics. This shift further changed the nature of motherhood. With children home and outside the public sphere of the market, the responsibility for raising them and nurturing the values of domesticity fell to mothers. The middle and upper classes during the 19th century who began this process provided the blueprint for the nostalgic version of home that continues to serve as a cultural idea even into our own time and that we celebrate on Mother's Day. The home became the physical representation of the refuge from the competitive and amoral, if not immoral, world of the public sphere. And as it was managed by women, the domestic sphere became the symbol of purity that women were supposed to represent. Moreover, the ongoing evolution of the nuclear family threw off many of the ties to extended kin that in prior generations opened the home to concerns beyond the marital dyad and their children. Although the house was seen as the woman's space, where domestic virtues set the rules of the game, men began to value the space of the home as a desirable change from their lives in the public sphere. Marriage, children, and home were increasingly supposed to be the sources of emotional satisfaction, and both genders largely accepted the idea that each needed to contribute their own sphere to encourage the creation of a rich domestic life. It is, at least in part, the vision of motherhood that we celebrate on Mother's Day. Even as we rightly recognize the increasing contributions of fathers to the domestic scene, Mother's Day tugs at us to a degree that Father's Day does not. We still, even as gender roles change, think of our moms in connection with our homes and with domestic virtues. We miss mom the cook, mom the nurse, mom the teacher, and mom the one who always loved us no matter what. That mom was yet another gift made possible by capitalism and the wealth it produced. As we honor motherhood on this day, we should take a moment to recognize and appreciate the ways in which capitalism and the freedoms that created it made modern motherhood possible. Of course, it is worth noting that while this shift in childhood, motherhood, and the home brought about many positive outcomes, it did not satisfy the needs of every individual, particularly those women who wanted to have a role outside the home. Here, again, capitalism played a significant role. The growing demand for labor associated with economic growth and greater prosperity within the family fueled changing social norms, freeing women to attend college and pursue careers beyond that of the homemaker if they so chose. Today, many families are able to decide whether both parents work, whether mom stays at home, or whether dad does, depending on what is best for them. The progress we have made is incredible, given that several hundred years ago, both parents were tied to both work and home. That article is by Stephen Horowitz. It was posted on the Foundation for Economic Education, fee.org. So it was capitalism that allowed parents to be able to stay home with their children and even allowed the children to stay home in the first place, because children had to go to work when they were younger, when we didn't have a whole lot of money, because otherwise the family would have starved. In fact, a lot of people would generally have children in the early 1900s to help out around the house and to help out with the farmlands and all of the production. Well, that's not really necessary anymore. And that's because we've allowed capitalism to build our prosperity to the point where we have enough accumulated that we can have the children stay at home and do whatever they'd like to do, learn, educate, go out and play outside. All of those things are accessible only because of capitalism. So what about child labor laws? I mean, these are what everybody hails as the thing that actually keeps children out of the workforce. But capitalism had been working on solving that problem for a long time before child labor laws ever came about. And when they did come about, they actually hindered and hampered people from getting jobs before a certain age and therefore learning about a work ethic at an age where they really could be out there serving other people and producing things for others. And Jeffrey Tucker is going to talk a little bit about this in his article, The Trouble with Child Labor Laws. Let's say you want your computer fixed or your software explained. You can shell out big bucks to the Geek Squad, or you can ask, but you can't hire, a typical teenager or even a preteen. Their experience with computers and the online world is vastly superior to that of most people over the age of 30. From the point of view of online technology, it is the young who rule. And yet they are professionally powerless. They are forbidden by law from earning wages from their expertise. Might these folks have something to offer the workplace? And might the young benefit from a bit of early work experience too? Perhaps, but we'll never know, thanks to antiquated federal, state, and local laws that make it a crime to hire a kid. Pop culture accepts these laws as a normal part of national life, a means to forestall a Dickensian nightmare of sweatshops and the capitalist exploitation of children. It's time we rid ourselves of images of children tied to rug looms in the developing world. The kids I'm talking about are one of the most courted of all consumer sectors. Society wants them to consume, but law forbids them to produce. You might be surprised to know that the laws against child labor do not date from the 18th century. Indeed, the national law against child labor didn't pass until the Great Depression in 1938 with the Fair Labor Standards Act. It was the same law that gave us a minimum wage and defined what constitutes full-time and part-time work. It was a handy way to raise wages and lower the unemployment rate, simply define the whole sectors of potential workforce as unemployable. By the time this legislation passed, however, it was mostly a symbol, a classic case of Washington chasing a trend in order to take credit for it. Youth labor was expected in the 17th and 18th centuries, even welcome, since remunerative work opportunities were newly present. But as prosperity grew with the advance of commerce, more kids left the workforce. By 1930, only 6.4% of kids between the ages of 10 and 15 were actually employed, and 3 out of 4 of those were in agriculture. In wealthier, urban, industrialized areas, child labor was largely gone, as more and more kids were becoming schooled. Cultural factors were important here, but the most important consideration was economic. More developed economies permit parents to purchase their children's education out of the family's surplus income, if only by foregoing what would otherwise be their earnings. The law itself then forestalled no nightmare, nor did it impose one. In those days, there was rising confidence that education was the key to saving the youth of America. Stay in school, get a degree or two, and you could be fixed up for life. Of course, that was before academic standards slipped further and further, and schools themselves began to function as a national child-sitting service. Today, we are far more likely to recognize the contribution that disciplined work makes to the formation of character. And yet, we are stuck with these laws, which are incredibly complicated once you factor in all state and local variations. Kids under the age of 16 are forbidden to earn income in remunerative employment outside of family business. If dad is a blacksmith, you can learn to pound iron with the best of them. But if dad works for a law firm, you are out of luck. From the outset, federal law made exceptions for kid movie stars and performers. Why? It probably has something to do with how Shirley Temple led box office receipts from 1934 to 1938. She was one of the highest earning stars of the period. If you are 14 or 15, you can ask your public school for a waiver and work a limited number of hours when school is not in session. And if you are in private school or homeschool, you must go ask your local social service agency, not exactly the most welcoming bunch. The public school itself is also permitted to run work programs. This point about approved labor is an interesting one if you think about it. The government doesn't seem to mind so much if a kid spends all non-school hours away from the home, family, and church, but it forbids them from engaging in private sector work during the time when they would otherwise be in public schools drinking from the well of civic culture. The legal exemption is also made for delivering newspapers, as if bicycles rather than cars were still the norm for this activity. Here's another strange exemption. Quote, youth working at home in the making of wreaths composed of natural holly, pine, cedar, or other evergreens, including the harvesting of the evergreens. Perhaps the wreath lobby was more powerful during the Great Depression than in our own time? Oh, and there is one final exemption, as incredible as this may be. Federal law allows states to allow kids to work for a state or local government at any age, and there are no hourly restrictions. Virginia, for example, allows this. The exceptions cut against the dominant theory of the laws that it is somehow evil to commodify the labor of kids. If it is wonderful to be a child movie star, congressional page, or home-based wreath maker, then why is it wrong for a teenage software fixer, a grocery bagger, or an ice cream scooper? It makes no sense. Once you get past the exceptions, the bottom line is clear. Full-time work in the private sector for hours of their own choosing is permitted only to those children who are 18 and older, by which time a child has already passed the age when he can be influenced toward a solid work ethic. What is lost in the bargain? Kids no longer have the choice to work for money. Parents who believe that their children would benefit from the experience are at a loss. Consumers who would today benefit from our teens' technological know-how have no commercial way to do so. They have been forcibly excluded from the matrix of exchange. There is a social-cultural point, too. Employers will tell you that most kids coming out of college are radically unprepared for a regular job. It's not so much that they lack skills or that they can't be trained. It's that they don't understand what it means to serve others in a workplace setting. They resent being told what to do, tend not to follow through, and work by the clock instead of the task. In other words, they are not socialized into how the labor market works. Indeed, if we perceive a culture of sloth, irresponsibility, and entitlement among today's youth, perhaps we ought to look here for a contributing factor. The law is rarely questioned today, but it is a fact that child labor laws did not come about easily. It took more than 100 years of wrangling. The first advocates of keeping children out of the factories were women's labor unions, who didn't appreciate the low-wage competition. And true to form, labor unions have been reliable exclusionists ever since. Opposition did not consist of mining companies looking for cheap labor, but rather parents and clergy alarmed that a law against child labor would be a blow against freedom. They predicted that it would amount to the nationalization of children, which is to say that the government, rather than the parents or the child, would emerge as the final authority and locus of decision-making. To give you a flavor of the opposition, consider this funny beatitude by Congressman Fritz G. Landman of Texas on the U.S. House floor in 1924 as a point of opposition to a child labor ban then being considered. Quote, consider the federal agent in the field. He toils not, nor does he spin. And yet I say unto you that even Solomon in all his populous household was not arrayed with powers like one of these. Children, obey your agents from Washington, for this is right. Honor thy father and thy mother, for the government has created them but a little lower than the federal agent. Love, honor, and disobey them. Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, tell it to thy father and mother, and let them do it. 6 days shalt thou do all thy rest, and on the seventh day thy parents shall rest with thee. Go to the bureau officer, thou sluggard, consider his ways, and be idle. Toll, thou farmer's wife, thou shalt have no servant in thy house, nor let thy children help thee. And all thy children shall be taught of the federal agent, and great shall be the peace of thy children. Thy children shall rise up and call the federal agent blessed. In every way, the opponents were right. Child labor laws were and are a blow against the freedom to work and a boost in government authority over the family. The political class thinks nothing of legislating on behalf of the children, as if they were the first owners of all kids. Child labor laws were the first big step in this direction, and the rest follows. If the state can dictate to parents and kids the terms under which teens can be paid, there is essentially nothing they cannot control. There is no sense in arguing about the details of the law. The critical question concerns the locus of decision-making, family or state, private markets or the public sector. In so many ways, child labor laws are an anachronism. There is no sense of speaking of exploitation as if this were the early years of the Industrial Revolution. Kids as young as 10 can surely contribute their labor in some ways and tasks that would help them to come to grips with the relationship between work and reward. They will learn to better respect private forms of social authority outside the home. They will come to understand that some things are expected of them in life. And after they finish college and enter the workforce, it won't come as such a shock the first time they are asked to do something that may not be their first choice. We know the glorious lessons that are imparted from productive work. What lesson do we impart with child labor laws? We establish early on who is in charge, not individuals, not parents, but the state. We tell the youth that they are better off being mall rats than fruitful workers. We tell them that they have nothing to offer society until they are 18 or so. We convey the impression that work is a form of exploitation from which they must be protected. We drive a huge social wedge between parents and children and lead kids to believe that they have nothing more to learn from their parents' experience. We rob them of what might otherwise be the most valuable early experiences of their young adulthood. In the end, the most compelling case for getting rid of child labor laws comes down to one central issue: the freedom to make a choice. Those who think young teens should do nothing but languish in classrooms in the day and play Wii at night will be no worse off. But those who see that remunerative work is a great experience for everyone will cheer to see this antique regulation toppled. Maybe then the kids of America can put their computer skills to use, doing more than playing World of Warcraft. That article was by Jeffrey A. Tucker. It was called The Trouble with Child Labor Laws, and it was posted on Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org. So we've talked a lot about how capitalism has increased our well-being and allowed us to have more time to spend fostering our relationships, our friendships, our familial bonds, and to have more time to spend with the people that we care about. Now, unfortunately, the government has done almost the exact opposite in some spheres of life for some people. Most notably, as Walter Williams has pointed out, the black family in the welfare state. A Wall Street Journal article citing an interview with Walter Williams says, "Even in the antebellum era, when slaves often weren't permitted to wed, most black children lived with a biological mother and father. During Reconstruction and up until the 1940s, 75 to 85% of black children lived in two-parent families. Today, more than 70% of black children are born to single women." Quote, "The welfare state has done to black Americans what slavery could not do, what Jim Crow could not do, what the harshest racism could not do," Mr. Williams says. "And that is to destroy the black family." So there we have it. Really, we have two choices in front of us. We have the market and we have the government. We have strengthening and fostering relationships within our family, or we have the failed central planning interventionist policies that the government has put in place, which has destroyed and ripped asunder our relationships and our families. So I'll leave you to reflect on which approach that you would like to take as you look back on your Mother's Day and your time spent with your family. Have a great week. Take care.